A warm welcome to the
Calling.
259th episode of Your Calling. We would particularly like to welcome our three speakers today. I shall be introducing them in a short while. My name is Maximilian Fries. I'm the Managing Director of Your Calling, and together with my colleague Amelie Passmann, I will be hosting the webinar tonight. We will be speaking mostly English tonight, and should you need assistance with that, we have two interpreters with us, and you can select the language under the small globe icon in the control panel.
And now I will continue in English so our guests and partners can understand me. Speaking of partners, this webinar is only possible because of a partnership between 38 Degrees, Campact, Zazim, Europe Calling, and Nodes. We all NGOs from UK, Germany, Israel, and Europe, and global as a whole, and throwing our weights and supporters behind this webinar. So no wonder we have close to 3,000 registrations from all over the world. Thank you to all who made that possible. So now to the topic of the day. Since the end of February, Israel and the US are at war with Iran. Very quickly, this war spread into the region, not only in the Gulf, but also into Lebanon and Gaza. Despite a formal ceasefire, fighting continues and the suffering is mounting. This is why we organized this webinar, to hear from voices from and on Iran, from Palestine and from Israel. Voices united by the opposition to the war, and voices that are in the region or in direct contact with people directly affected. We want to listen and we want to give room for the views and voices. And today we'll be in two parts. In the first part, we will hear roughly 10-minute long testimonials from our speakers. So that's the listening part, on their background, their connections, their situation and their activism. And in the second part, we will dig deeper to the geopolitics and the question of international solidarity. After both parts, we'll have time for your questions. For those questions you can all ask, we are using the tool Slido, where you can ask your questions and upvote the questions of others. So give them just a thumbs up if you like the question. That way, we can easily choose the questions that interest you the most. We'll also put the link now for that in the chat and the mobile code so you can get started asking questions. As always, Europe Calling will be recorded and published on YouTube and as podcast afterwards. And that's it with the service announcement, and we're going to start with our testimonials. I will first introduce our three guests and then give them the floor. So our first guest, Sarah Haghdousti. Among her many roles, Sarah is both a seasoned organizer for progressive causes as well as a novelist. She was born in Iran, lived in Australia, and is now based in the United States. Currently, she's the chief of program for the political action committee Move On. She formerly was the executive director of Win Without War, a progressive foreign policy organization with hundreds of thousands of activists across the country. Sarah also founded Berim, Let's Go in Farsi, a nonprofit that worked to support changemakers in Iran. Many very good reasons to have Sarah here. So Sarah, great to have you. Our second speaker then will be Amira. Amira Musallam is a Palestinian Christian peace activist and the head of mission and co-founder of Unarmed Civilian Protection in Palestine, an initiative coordinating protective presence, documentation, and international advocacy in high-risk Palestinian communities in the West Bank. Amira has worked with many international civil society networks and advocating for civilian protection and accountability. Mira has spoken to United Nations, engages policymakers internationally, and centers the voices of Palestinian women and families facing dispossession and war. And our third speaker is Sarit Lari. She's an active member of Israeli civil society. She currently serves as deputy executive director of content and strategy at Zazim Community Action. Prior to this role, she founded and led the academia division at ACORD, Social Psychology for Social Change, and served as co-director of Mahapach Tahrir, a feminist grassroots Jewish Arab organization for social change. And you see, we have three amazing guests. Really, it's a big, big honor to have that panel, also to have three women on the panel. So I will actually take myself back, hand over very shortly after testimonials to Amelie, and just give you the floor for your testimonials and for your views and your emotions that you want to share with us. So all great to have you, and over to Sarah for the first testimonial. Sarah. Sarah.
Brilliant. First of all, thank you all so much for having me. It is such a privilege to be talking to you all, though I wish it was in different circumstances and on a different topic. But here we are. So I'm going to start by sharing some of my story. So to tell you all a bit about me, I was born in Iran. I still have a lot of family there. I currently live in the US, and my husband is also Jewish, and we have children who were raising in both Jewish and Muslim traditions, which has given us a very interesting perspective in this moment. And one thing that I want to share with all of you is every day when I look at my kids, I remember that what we are currently living through in the context of the Middle East is not inevitable. We were not designed to have conflict. That has been choices that leaders have made over and over again to pit so many of these communities against each other. And in so many other ways, so much of our communities have such long, beautiful histories of not just coexistence, but really thriving together when the like different principles had been applied. And before I get into more of this moment, I also just want to acknowledge that when we talk about war, it is often so easy to talk about the headlines, to talk about the folks in power. And I know, like, both for me and so many others, be they folks who have like who are in the region, in Israel, in Gaza, in Palestine, throughout the Middle East, in Lebanon, or through the like over 10 countries that have had bombs rain down on them over the last few weeks, or folks who have family who are in military service right now, that like agonizing worry about like if you try to make a phone call to a loved one and if they are going to answer, and the stress of the sleepless nights, the trying to figure out how to talk and make sense of this to kids as a parent, is just, it's so heavy. It's so real. It is so consuming. And for the folks who have been experiencing that day in and day out, I just want to say that both you are not alone, and that none of us should have ever been put into this position. Again, we are here because a series of choices have been made that have been putting the safety and the political ambitions of leaders ahead of our safety. And I fundamentally believe that our safety as people is intertwined. I spent a lot of time in Australia, and one of my favorite sayings there was from an Indigenous elder who said, like, if you have come here to save me, you are wasting your time. But if you've come here because your liberation is bound up in mine, then we can work together. And I think that is, for me, such a guiding principle in this moment. Now, other things I want to share about Iran right now that folks might know is that it has genuinely been a really horrific year. I am someone who is deeply anti this regime. I am deeply anti authoritarianism wherever I see it. And the Iranian regime has been doing horrific things for a long time, but especially at the beginning of this year when there was mass protests and uprisings, they oversaw a really horrific massacre of up to, estimates still range between 10 to 20,000 people. And as we talk about solutions, I think it is also really important not to erase the authoritarianism that is happening in Iran and what this government has done. So I just want to pull that because that is a really key part of this story. And like what I fundamentally believe is, like, from what we've seen in Afghanistan, in Iraq, wars do not help take away authoritarianism. 20 years of war didn't eradicate the Taliban. And what we've seen in Iraq isn't a vision of freedom at this point either, right? So, really thinking about as people who not just want to see peace, but who want to see thriving. Like, I genuinely want to see people in the Middle East being able to not just have dignity, but thrive without the fear of violence. It means we need to be more creative with how we're thinking about solutions. And it really means that instead of always talking about the same broken leaders, we need to do a better job of uplifting the voices of civil society and the people who are actually at the forefront of creating transformation. And I know there are so many of those organizations across the Middle East who are truly doing heroic work and that we need to be doing uplifting more of. The other thing I want folks to know is that over the past 20 years, there has also been a policy of collective punishment around Iran. When you look at the context of sanctions have like become this like word that we, in any kind of foreign policy context where things feel difficult, the answer tends to be sanctions. And so often that is a policy of collective punishment, right? The Iranian people have not chosen their government. If anything, they have spent longer than I have been breathing, fighting for freedom and fighting for liberation, and yet consistently are punished for decisions that they have had no part in. And now we have seen enough evidence that sanctions don't actually aid people in liberation. They actually help consolidate authoritarianism. They destroy middle classes, they concentrate power and wealth. Broad-based sanctions make authoritarians stronger. They don't help movements. So that's the other big thing I wanted for you to pull out from today. So when I try to reach my family right now, there's an internet blackout in Iran. It is actually really hard to contact people in Iran. I wrote a guide for like how do you even talk to people who might have family in Iran right now? And one of my asks was don't ask about their families, because for so many of us, we don't know. Like being able to just get in touch with them right now is really hard. So like people might be able to get through to their families once every few weeks if they're lucky, right? And then I know that when I've been out and about and people like, they're like, oh, are they okay? If I say, like, well, they didn't die, people are like, that's great. And I'm like, I actually want more than that for my family, right? Like, them not being stuck in rubble is not the bar that I have for my family, right? And that is where the context of sanctions also comes in. Like, I want people in Iran to be able to access medicine. I don't want folks to be like struggling to find food and others. And like, is some of that part of the like all of the horrendousness of the Iranian regime? Yes. But also, when you know a regime is terrible and you have a policy of broad-based sanctions, you also know that you are telling people that they are going to suffer even though they had no part in it. So I will just say things are really hard. This war. The only thing I believe so far it has done is really consolidate the Iranian regime and led to horrendous outcomes. I think it has made people in Iran less safe. It has made people in the US less safe and has made people in the region less safe as well. And with that, I'll hand it back to you all.
Yeah, thank you so much for this very, very, very strong testimonial introduction. I think it's really, I won't comment on it at all because I think it speaks for itself. We just let it sit and let it resonate. And maybe one thing I'm gonna say. It's like when you say we want to give people that are there in civil society a bigger voice. This is exactly why we're doing this webinar, and this is why it's so great that you are here and others are here, because this is so important. We have spoken so much about Trump and everyone, right, and Netanyahu and stuff, but it's really important that we speak and hear from the people, and that's so important. So thank you for being part of that. And going to go to our second testimonial from Amira Musalam. Already introduced you at the beginning, Amira. Leah, are you here and able to speak? Because I see you're muted and your camera's off. If not, we can also give you more time, and we just change the order a bit. Amira. Right, so I'd say we give Amira some time, and then continue with Sarit, who also introduced, who's from Sassim in Israel. And Sarit, please take the floor.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you, Sarah, for your words. They already gave me power. This is amazing. Thank you so much. I'm very honored to be here. And exactly like Sarah said, I wish it was better circumstances. But I am happy about this conversation. And a little bit nervous, and I want to share an anecdote to explain why. So we sent from Zazim an invitation for this call, and many people started registering and made us very happy. Thank you all for coming. But we have few animated responses to this call, and there were of two kinds. One kind said, "Why are you only going to talk about other nations and not about the suffering that we are going through in Israel with this government and with these missiles, et cetera, et cetera?" This is one. I didn't even utter a word. And the other response was, "Why are you not going to mention what Israel is inflicting on the area and only talk about Israelis and the suffering? This government is inflicting this horrible thing." Okay, so we had these two completely different responses. And I didn't have to say anything. And I felt I understand them both. If I had to give a title for Israel at the moment, and it comes from this anecdote, dichotomy. Israel is extremely polarized at the moment. There's a lot of stress that's been happening for something like 7 years. I mean, the war, this war we are talking about, in fact, it's not happening in a void, of course. So it's this polarized society between you are with us or you are against us kind of a feeling that I can relate to. I can understand where the feeling is coming from. I don't think it comes from a bad place. It comes from pain. But I do want to use this conversation to try and challenge this dichotomy a little bit. And maybe it's ambitious, but I want to hold the stick in both ends, and let's see if I manage to actually do it. So as Max generously presented me, I have been a part of civil society in Israel for the best part of 12 years, and I have worked in human rights organization, and I have worked in mobilizing for voting organization to try to take the Netanyahu, to replace the Netanyahu. I want to say government or regime. I don't know what word I should say. I was part of a feminist organization, and now I work in Zazim as a deputy ED. So a big part of my life is dedicated for a while now for changing Israel for the better. It's something that I do. But funnily enough, my relationship, not surprisingly maybe, my relationship to Israel is a dichotomy. There's a part of me wants to be a part of change and do all the things that I do. It's a list I'm proud of, and it's not a short list. And part of me wants to run away. This also happens. As I run with my 8.5-year-old to my neighbor's shelter, because we don't have shelter, as a third of Israel doesn't have a shelter. At night, when sirens are going, are in the air, and you hear explosions. It's not a long run to my neighbor's shelter, and I have such generous neighbors. I'm very, very lucky that way. But still, it's night, and it's, I woken up my kid, and we ran there quickly. We have this amount of time to go in there, a minute and a half. And I can't help feeling basically that I failed him as a mother. I think Sarah mentioned it at the beginning. Sarah mentioned it at the beginning of her talk. I failed not because I did anything, but I failed in not being able to stop this experience from his childhood. And it's not even an experience of one time, okay? So it's several times. And so we ran to my neighbor, and really, I have the best neighbors. I don't think anybody in the world have neighbors like ours. And we sit there with their family and the kids and the grandkids and the dog, and I come with my family, and we have a dog too, and everybody, and we close the door, and I let my heart, I got to start breathing again. And I think to myself, as I put a blanket over my child so that it is warm again, I'm lucky compared to others. I'm lucky. Other people, for example, Arabs in Israel, Palestinian citizens of Israel, have 0.3% of shelters, of all shelters in Israel. They're a fifth of the population. In Gaza, in the West Bank, and the West Bank that is still under Israeli control, there's a pogroms, they have no sirens. Amira will tell, I don't want to take her testimonials, but this is what I know. Not all countries have defense like Israel has. I'm lucky. This is what I think to myself in the shelter with my son in the middle of the night. And then something else rebels and says, what kind of lucky is this? And again, Sarah, I prepared this a while ago, but I felt as you were speaking how your words resonated with my experience. I felt, I want more. I don't want this to be the norm of the, I don't want this to be lucky. Okay. I want to live in a place that has a horizon, a place when I can thrive in, a place where I don't have to really struggle in order to teach my son compassion to other people because the place he lives in is so polarized and so tense. And so I oscillate like the people who wrote to us about this talk between wanting to stay and wanting to run, and obviously I stay. Worry about this war, not only when it actually goes on, I worry about the reasons behind this war. Pardon me, I had to write the notes because it's such a complex subject and deeply felt. From 2019, our prime minister stood a criminal trial. Since then, he has done many things to make sure that he stays in power and can influence his tribe, but one of them was to use the far, far, far right in Israel and bring it into power positions in Israel. Police, for example. This kind of a combination makes one feel, as I sit in the shelter, that the reasons for this war are not reason to take into account any citizens, not the citizens of the area, which we should take into account, even his own citizens. It seems like the interests are extremely personal, extremely narrow, or at the other hand, extremely messianic and ideological in a way that is scary. War helps him, helps his government, and definitely helps the far right. The far right sees it as a miracle. They say so. It is a time of miracle, this war and bloodshed everywhere, including Gaza, including October 7th, a time of miracle. War strengthens, gives them strength and weakens us because Although Israel has shown inspiring power of demonstrating, since 2019, we have seen thousands, hundreds of thousands in the streets, in the rain, in the heat, in many conditions that were very, very difficult. But it has been 7 years, and there is a lack of accountability of our government, which makes it hard. As one runs to, I spoke to a friend the other day, and she said, I'm walking with my partner and with our two kids to the shelter. It's 5 minutes away. We have to run there. And everybody, they look like soldiers to me. And I think to myself, I have no power in resisting. This is an activist talking, yes? I'm just walking like a soldier to the shelter quickly. And at the same time, I have the fear of death in me as I do this. War weakens the ability to resist. It won't break us, but it is definitely a challenge. I don't want to end in a dark note, although I do think these are dark times. But I will say something that is weirdly optimistic. You will understand why weirdly soon. So Bibi said, and Netanyahu said, war. And 2 seconds after that, millions are affected, right? And then Trump says, no war. Done. I'm done. I'm done playing this. And suddenly, quiet. And this moment where definitely one can feel helpless also reminded me, again, Sarah, sorry, you said it first, but I want to echo what you say. War and peace are both decisions. They are both decisions of people. If somebody like Netanyahu can decide that there is war and there is, and somebody like Trump can stop it in an hour, okay, this is a good moment to remember that that both of them are a choice. And that means that we do have a power to change that and to have a future that is stable, that has an horizon, and in which maybe we can visit each other. We even have example. We have Egypt and we have Jordan. Peace works. And with that, I turn you back to Max.
Thank you so much for sharing this and for ending with this hope. I have a my sons are 9 and 6. I can't really imagine how it must feel like what you described. So it's really horrifying, but that's still amazing that you still have that hope that you described. So thank you for sharing that. And we will speak about more also geopolitics at the end of it, of the webinar. But as you said it, I just want to post the New York Times article actually, on the question how this decision came about between Netanyahu and Trump. And I think this is very important as a kind of background reading. Also when we speak more about, the geopolitics of things, how this actually came about and, what actually was the driving force behind it. And it's not about peace. Was never about regime change, peace, or anything. So it's very, very clear. So I'm just going to share this here, and then we send it to the webinar as well. And now, Amira, nice to see you and hear you now as well. Okay, I already introduced you at the beginning. I'm just going to repeat quickly in a short form for people that joined a bit later. Amira Mousalem, Palestinian Christian peace activist and head of mission and co-founder of Unarmed Civilian Protection in Palestine, and has had many other roles she worked. So Amira, so great to have you, and we're looking forward to what you have to say.
Yes, good evening, everyone. My name is Amira. I'm from Bethlehem. I was born in Bethlehem, was raised in Bethlehem, and now sitting in Bethlehem. And actually, I was a little bit late from entering the webinar, and I was so confused also with the time. But I just came back from giving, I don't like to call it a lecture because it's not. It was a conversation with 50 students, Israeli students who are going next year to the IDF. They are in the preparatory year, the Mechina, they call it. And they called me to talk to me to hear what does it mean to be a Palestinian from, And it was a very interesting conversation to speak with a 17 years old who has never seen Palestinian, only on TV, on their TV, where they will see us as terrorists and they will not see anything else. And when they saw me, actually, they were surprised to see me, for example, without hijab, you know, a woman speaking up, even smoking a cigarette. That was shocking for them, because they don't know the wall, the apartheid wall that was built 2000, 2001. It wasn't for security. It was to feed the fear of the two peoples, and especially on in Israeli on the Israeli side, where they are telling them that we are on this side a terrorist. And I was for 2 hours speaking about my personal story, which I will share with you. And when I was 12 years old, from here where I am sitting now, it was a vacation day here in Palestine. It's the 15th of November. We call it the Independence Day and we celebrate it. Even we are not independent. It's something that has to do with the Palestinian Authority and Fatah and so on. And I was 12 years old. I was studying an Arabic exam. It was 6 o'clock in the afternoon when we heard some bullets very close to our house. 10 minutes after, we heard rockets, like bombs. From the nearby settlement, which is Gilo. Gilo, it's around like 2 kilos from here. It's on the top of the hill, and I'm like living down in the valley. And I ran into the house, my dad with my two sisters, Jessica, who was 6 years old, my Gina was 16 back then. We tried to find the safest spot in the house. And we hid in one place where we thought it was safe. My mom got stuck because she was at work, but she didn't accept to stay away. And she said, you know, I have to risk it. I have to be with my family. And she risked it all. Even there was like bombing everywhere in the street, but she made it through to the house. That night was the night that changed everything for me. As a 12 years old girl who lived, let's not say a normal life, a childhood, but a good childhood where I experienced to go with our own car to Haifa and Akko and Tel Aviv and Yaffa and having Israeli friends, inviting them to our house. They would come, we would go to them. I used to play even in the settlement nearby. I used to play in the parks with the children there. And it was, for a child like me, it was a beautiful life. Nothing wrong. I didn't understand back then Israel-Palestine story. But that night, I got like really shocked because that's the night where the kids who I used to play with, my friends, who I didn't understand the word they said because they used to speak in Hebrew and I don't speak Hebrew, became my enemy suddenly. And they were trying to kill me and my family by throwing bombs on our house from the tanks in the settlement. We tried to hide until some small rockets and bullets came in where we were hiding. So we needed to escape. We called the first thing that came to our mind, an ambulance, where we thought an ambulance could access the area and get us out. But the man on the phone, I remember his voice, he said, "Sorry, ma'am, we cannot access the area. They are targeting our cars." The next thing, we called the American embassy. I have a second citizenship. I never lived in the States, but I got it from my parents who lived for a few years in the States. And we called the embassy because that's what your embassy should do, you know, help you get out of any kind of danger. The American embassy was very honest. "You are Palestinian. We cannot help you. You are in Palestine. If you were in, let's say, India, we can help you, but in Palestine, no." And they hanged the phone. And the only thing that we had is pray because we couldn't escape the house. Then our neighbors who are next to us told my dad that we need to go to their house because their house is the lower level and it's not very exposed. The only problem that there was a big gate between us and them, which worked only on electricity, and there was no electricity because it was all bombed. So my dad again risked it. He went out. We waited for him on the side of the house with our blankets because it was November. It was cold a little bit. And he went to that gate with our neighbor, who's an older woman. She was carrying Saint Nicholas picture because she believes he makes miracles, talking about miracles, Sarit. And they tried to make open the gate for us to pass. Great, thank God. We passed carrying a white shawl, telling the helicopters, which were above our heads, that we are civilians, that we are peaceful, like, hey, look at us. Because that same night, a German doctor, Dr. Fischer, who was our neighbor and was married to a Palestinian woman, he was bombed from a helicopter trying to help us because they thought he was terrorist or whatever. So I spent that night 12 hours with my family praying every time we saw the bombs coming out from the helicopter. You would see the light coming out, and then it's like in front of me in over Beit Jalla, the view, and the light comes out, and then you feel the heat of the missile. It was like shh, and then you fly from the ground up there, and you fall down again from the impact. They shot around four missiles from the helicopter. Thank God nothing happened to us. It wasn't even on our house. It was on our neighbor's house where 27 people were hiding. The next day, the most horrifying thing I saw in my life was cats and dogs eating human flesh. It was our neighbor who was bombed from a missile. And even with all of that, even I was 12 years old and living in a Christian family, believing in Jesus and the teaching of Jesus, I didn't accept to be in the road of hating and revenge. And since that moment, even as a little girl, I believed that violence brings more violence, blood brings more blood, and it's a never-ending cycle, and there should be another way. I don't know exactly the way, because if we knew it, we could all be working for it. But small steps, we could change the status quo. We could change the suffering for all of us here. And then I worked for so many years, like different organizations, and I attended all kind of peace meetings with Israelis to talk about coexistence. But you know what? We don't have a problem to coexist. Our problem is not coexistent. Our problem is to stop these governments from feeding the fear in us, and stop the governments from dehumanizing us and allow people to just understand that we are just normal people who want to live in freedom and equality. You name all the things that we want. And that brought me all the way to my work now. And I will finish. Give me 1 minute to give space for everyone. And that brought me to now to co-found what we call Unarmed Civilian Protection in Palestine, which is an initiative that is Palestinian-led, where we do protective presence. We go do 24/7 protective presence for the communities who are being attacked by backstage settler violence. And we have been in the field since last July, And we do accompaniment, we do 24/7 protective presence. We stay with the communities, we share their sorrows, their happy times, even their weddings. Even if we are not able to stop the ethnic cleansing of these communities, we are there with them, crying with them when the time comes. So yeah, thank you for now.
Thank you so much also for sharing that. As I promised, I'm now handing over to Amelie for the many questions we already got. We got questions from the Q&A, and then we're going to have the second part. So Amelie, let us know what the big questions are from the audience.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. There's a lot of interest in a variety of topics. I think I would start with a question about Iran, so giving it to Sarah. How many different factions or ideas do you see within the Iranian community? So the question asks, for example, do you distinguish between left-wingers and communists, and how do these different opposition parties then work together against the regime?
So, I mean, again, Iran has a huge population. It is not a monolith, and there are a wide variety of different political opinions. And again, this is the story of tragedy and hope in Iran. Like, people, change makers from all kinds of different walks of life have been systematically like imprisoned, executed, sidelined, etc. for longer than I've been alive, right? And from before this regime, right? The Shah before then did a lot of work to destroy various leftist movements as well, right? And I think that's an important thing to remember as part of some of this dialogue that is happening. For me, like, it is less about thinking about the different factions of change inside Iran. And like, one thing I think that is a story not told is that a lot of times when civil society in Iran has been on the cusp of change, it has actually been foreign intervention that has stopped it. So a lot of people don't know about the CIA's coup in the 1950s. So Iranians elected, had a democratically elected president who decided to nationalize oil fields. And then the CIA had a coup and helped reinstate the Shah, right? So there's been like a very long tradition of like imperialism and colonialism in Iran as well. And right now, the question for me is like, how can you create more space for people in Iran to be able to communicate outside of the country? Again, the current like internet shutdown, it's one of the longest that has ever happened in the country, is really stopping that. But also, again, Amira and Sari did a beautiful job explaining that like violence makes it so much harder for civil society to operate. And when you have like consistent wars, when you have policies of collective punishment, that has also helped destroy so much of civil society in Iran. We've seen more executions happening over the last few weeks because now the Iranian government is using the war as an excuse to detain, execute anyone who disagrees with it. So for me, it's less around like pick a faction and more about how do you create a larger surface area for people to be able to even talk about what a future they want looks like.
Thank you so much for that answer. And I think we talked a bit about how, war is often a decision made top down. Like, it's not a decision made by the people. They don't want the war that, global leaders may decide they want. So another question we have from Katerina is, How much support is there within Israeli society for the wars in Gaza and Iran? Is it like, Netanyahu's desire to remain in power, as you said? And then connected to that question, maybe I don't know if you have any predictions if there's upcoming elections this year. What do you think is the impact that might have on policies?
Good questions. Dichotomy. There is sadly, there is a lot of support for Netanyahu. He's not in power without support. This is not the case with him. He's a popular leader. There's also very strong opposition to him, and the polls don't look good right now. But when we say the polls don't look good, we don't mean that the 1 million people that always will go with him have changed. That has not changed. It did not grow, but it did not change. I would say something about war that I was debating if I was going to say here because it's a bit complex, but I think the dialogue is really nuanced, so I'll dare say it. If Amira is talking to IDF people in the Mechina, there is a reason why soldiers are drafted when they are 18. Okay, there's a reason. It's not because it's the point in life when you are the smartest, where you make the best decisions, where you get everything, etc. It is a moment of extreme independence and extremely vibrant and fragile when it comes to the ability to predict what your deeds mean for your life or what it means to another. I would use harsher words, but yes, there is a reason that armies are not made of older people, etc. This is the reason. They pick people who just finished childhood, if so. Okay, I remember myself 18. Yes, I was 18 as well. I know how it feels. So that's one thing. So of course the some kind of excitement about the army is very widespread in Israel, and the draft and there's a draft in Israel. It's obligatory. It's something that you are being prompted to do. And you really need to work against it because it is honored. It's everybody's children. It's everybody's cousins. It's everybody's fathers. It's not something that is considered to be a profession or something like that. We do see that, and this is it happened more than once in the last few years, that when war is being initiated or whatever, not only the right goes with this, there's some kind of patriotism that is militant in Israeli society that will not say no to the IDF. For the most part, I don't want to say everybody, but I do think this happens for the most part. I think slowly, because the interests are becoming so obvious and so narrow, we began to hear talks about refusing in the last 3 years that are more widespread. We at the ZIM had a whole campaign calling on people to refuse the war in Gaza. I'm sorry, I don't have a final line. I do think it has support. I do think the support has cracks in it. But IDF in Israel is an institution, and all the leaders come from it. All the So opposing it is hard, and I think the government knows that. It's almost treason to say something bad about the IDF in Israel. And I don't mean you will be sued. I mean socially, it is very costly. I hope I'm clear.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Amira, do you want to add anything, maybe also from the talks you had with people preparing for the IDF from your perspective?
Yes, these kids, as Sarit said, these kids are 17 years old, 18 years old now, preparing for the IDF, and all what they know is that they are going to the army. They don't care what the army does. They don't care what the system is. They don't care if they end up, for now, in this moment, like in this age, they are so excited. They think that, IDF is freedom. You are going to live outside of your parents' house and it's fun. Then the problem comes. But like in that moment, and a lot of these kids who I met today, they were like more open because they were like asking questions. They are meeting different organizations. And even like Breaking the Silence, who are an important organization who is exposing the IDF. So, for example, tomorrow they are meeting with them. So they are doing the knowledge, and they are going and searching for all these questions and answers. But again, as Sarit said, there is something more powerful than just a decision I want to make at 18. It's the whole system. My family, my cousins, my friends. If I don't go to the IDF, I'm talking like in their tongue. If they don't go there, they will like the community they are living in. They will abandon them. They will hate them. They will maybe not include them in their social activities. And for an 18 years old, of course not. I will go to the IDF. And then if you refuse, then you will go to jail. And an 18 years old, even is not ready to join 1 year of jail because he's refusing an IDF. So it's a complex situation, and I think it doesn't start at age 18. It starts much, much younger than that. It's the whole education system. It's the whole, the different schools that they go to the different synagogues they go to. It depends who they listen to. So it's very complex, and I think the solution and the way out of this is not the governments. The governments are benefiting from this conflict. On your side, for example, Sarit, it's Bibi Netanyahu who's, running from the court. On our side, the leaders are benefiting financially from this whole conflict. Why do to end it if they are benefiting? So thank you.
Thank you very much, Amira. I want to read out one question that's not really a question, but I think it sums up what a lot of people in this call might also be feeling. And it's an anonymous comment that said, "After these three profound personal statements, I can't think of anything else to ask because everything I want to ask seems trivial in comparison." And I think I just wanted to echo this because, of course, we're like really grateful that you're opening up and you're sharing these personal experiences. Yeah, because I think, like myself, many other people probably also haven't, heard directly from people involved yet. So, yeah, just thank you very much again. And one question, it was something I think Sarah mentioned in the beginning about sanctions and sanctions working or not working. And we have quite a few questions on that. For example, from Saskia. So, if you say sanctions don't work, what other tools are there for governments to put pressure, for example, on the Iranian regime? Or, there's also other questions about possible solutions for the conflict that aren't sanctions, then maybe that can be brought by civil society. So, if all three of you, if you have any thoughts on this, yeah, feel free to give your thoughts.
So, one nuance I want to say here. Targeted sanctions, I think, can be effective, right? So, like, if there's particular judges in Iran that are like saying yes to executing protesters, they should 100% be sanctioned, and we should like make sure that like they can't, like, there should be international accountability for that. What I'm saying doesn't work is broad-based sanctions. Right. So, like, when you're sanctioning entire banking systems and then people are like sanctioning things where like people then can't access food or medicine, that's where things start collapsing. Right. And then to me, it's how do you create more space for people to thrive? Right. So, it's like, how can you actually make it safer for more people-to-people exchanges coming to Iran? How do we get better internet infrastructure and support more internet freedom in Iran? And there's like, again, there's been these like technical carve-outs for technology for a long time, and they don't work because the technology companies are like, why would I go anywhere near this if I don't have to, right? So it's looking at things like that, right? So like, how are you, how, what are the policy solutions that help more communication, that help more people have a greater economic access and help more shared understanding to like, at the very least, get at the huge dehumanization problem we have right now.
I
Thank you.
would like to add about sanctions. We tried sanctions in Palestine, in the West Bank, especially the past few years with settlers. And many countries did sanctions on settlers. Problem is, those settlers are individuals. So even if you sanction an individual, it's easy to get another person to get the money, for example, if he can't access the bank. So I think, Sarah, I agree with you on sanctions should go bigger than only targeting individuals or small organization or small company. It should go bigger on, for example, I will give this just an example. For example, the other day we had, I gave a brief in the House representative in the United States about bulldozers. That are used to demolish homes in the West Bank and in Gaza, of course, what we saw. And for the first time in history, after they heard the stories and so on, these politicians, 70 out of 74 votes, or I'm confused with the number, but like very high number of votes from the House representative voted against to stop sending these bulldozers to Israel. And this, this something like this helps. And even if a decision came out for sanctions for this big company, I don't want to say names, but like for this big company, it could hurt more than just, sanctioning a person or a small organization. It should be go bigger. Those who are feeding the war, who are benefiting out of the war, whether it's companies, whether it's high tech, whether it's banks, whether it's, but the, like the big names, I'm not talking about small local ones, the big names that are benefiting out of our suffering on the in the three countries.
Yeah, I think this is an excellent debate, actually. There are many tools to try and make the world better that are non-violent. And some, like every tool, if you use it wrong or you aim it in the wrong, might do damage, like you say, denying healthcare, denying internet, denying, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, I completely see what Amira is saying. And I remember this in another context. I didn't speak about this now, but one of the things that our government, that Bibi, that Netanyahu is doing in order to run away from his trial, like you said beautifully and to the point, is trying to hurt the judicial, what is left of the judicial branch in Israel. And so we saw. People being at some part, people being afraid of investing in Israel because it became unstable. We had demonstrations and the occasion war and whatever. And the high tech went was very scared. This was a lot of interviews, in Israel, and it has something to do with Israeli identity, high tech nation kind of thing. It's an identity thing as well. I think it did scare people and it did slow them down a little bit at first. I do think that is true. I do think that at the end of the day, it cannot work with people who don't care about their citizens. Sanctions work when at the end of the day, they care about the people are being that are being they care about the country. They have to be a little bit in a place of accountability. When the accountability is lacking completely, I agree that it will do nothing but damage. I did see it work, though, as Amira said. I did see some kind of sanctions like that work. So maybe like a piano. Play it with care. Yeah.
Thank you very much all for your answers. I think we've kind of naturally already gone over into the second part of the webinar that we were planning anyway. So that's really good. So the second part also for the Slido Q&A, we're gonna switch to the second page. I'm gonna send the link again in the chat. Yeah, there's a lot more question about the geopolitical context. Of course, this is not happening within a vacuum. I think you know, we've made that very clear. For example, one of the questions by Bob, I don't know, it's specifically for Mira. If you're there, yeah, okay, perfect. He asked, would you talk about what is happening as Palestine begins to prepare for the nationwide elections for the first ones in more than 15 years? So do you think it's part of the process that is being done openly, fairly, and transparently? You know, how who will be up for vote, what are the options, but how do you see it?
Yes, honestly, the elections, if they happen, because we have been saying that they will happen and then they are canceled and so on. If they happen, I hope, I wish, like every citizen of the world, they wish from their country to have decent people, going to the elections instead of the same faces that we have been seeing for the past 30 years or since the 90s. And people who care about Palestine, about the future of Palestine, the process will be decent. The process will be visible and transparent. It's not like we have corruption and so on in these events. Our problem, even if these new faces won or got, to the elections and so on, we have a big problem, which is Israel. Our government, and I'm not sure if everybody is aware, but the Palestinian Authority, our government, cannot move the glass from here to here without the blessing or the permission of Israel. So even if we do the best elections in the world, the best everything, we have the best leader who lead us from now on. It doesn't change that Israel has the key to all our, to solving all our problems. They control everything. They control the air that we are breathing now, right now. So what do you think? What do you expect from elections that are under occupation? It's just even if it will be perfect, we don't see it will change anything. At the end of the day, for me as Amira, I'm Palestinian and American citizen, I am banned by Israel to go to Jerusalem to pray in the church, because they have the keys, they have the permission, they can tell us what to do or what not to do. If I speak too much, they will put me in jail. If I go to jail, God knows what will happen to me. And so let's focus not on the elections, but focus on the roots of our problem here, the occupation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amira. I think if it's fine for everyone, instead of giving you the 3 to 5 minutes, we would just continue asking questions because there are so many. I think there's a lot of interest, especially from, we have a lot of German people here, a lot of different European nationalities as well. And one of the questions is essentially, what can we do from the outside? So we heard, it's very difficult, also especially in Iran, fighting both from the outside and the inside. It's a two front situation as well. Yeah, essentially, what can civil society outside of Iran and Palestine, Israel, do? Yeah, to help the peace movements in your countries. I think that's a question for everyone. Sarah, if you want to start again or
Amira, you start this time.
And actually, because this question, I'm asked this question in all the webinars, like, what can we do? How can we help? And mostly I normally speak with American audience, but I was very happy to speak now with like Europeans. And I prepared like some notes, and I will read it for you because I wanted really to give you practical things to do. So first of all, by coming to this webinar, you are on your first steps to helping, the three countries and help to do something. So by listening to those directly affected and amplifying real voices from the ground, too often others speak for us while those living in the reality are ignored. Second, by asking European institutions to be consistent with the values they promote, human rights, dignity, democracy, and rule of law must apply equally to everyone. Third, by supporting organizations doing real work. And I know that everybody needs, support. All the NGOs in the world need support, and especially with all, financial crises around the world and wars and so on. But you don't have to donate in money, you can do all kind of work and support, trauma support, legal advocacy, nonviolent civilian protection, and of course, grassroots peace building. Fourth, by challenging anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, racism, and all forms of dehumanization, peace cannot grow where hatred is tolerated. So go contact elected representatives, support ethical and credible organizations, stay informed through reliable sources. We people here in Palestine are out of solutions, and we can't do anything more than be resilient or leave very soon because it's too hard on all levels. We need you to speak up. We need you to go to your government. The solution is in the hand of the governments, not in that aspect, to stop Israel from doing everything they are doing. It's the solution is there. The governments should be pressuring Israeli government. Even we Palestinians could work, Palestinians and Israel could work on the ground and civil societies and do lots of work. And but at the end of the day, like what happened, for example, in January, where we were doing 24/7 protective presence for this Bedouin community of 600 people. We were with them 7 months, 24/7, doing this work. In January, they left. They were not left. They were ethnically cleansed by the settlers and the IDF and the police. We can't do anything. We couldn't do anything for them. We packed with them their stuff and cried with them while they were leaving their houses and their lands. And we need you. We need people around the world to pressure their government to go to elections and elect good people. Not the people who are on Epstein files, for example. So we need you. Like, really, we need the pressure. The pressure is working. So I think this is a little bit.
I just want to deeply underline everything Amira just said. And what I'll say is often people don't take action on these issues because they're like, but it's too complicated, or what can I actually achieve? And I want you to know you already have everything you need in order to have impact, right? The reason people are often made to feel like you don't know enough, or unless you have three PhDs, you shouldn't have an opinion on this, is because that lets the status quo keep going. Right. The reason why you don't see people like us talking about the experiences of what it is like being part of impacted communities is because by shutting us out of those conversations, the status quo can get repeated. Right. So just that. And I also want to say this isn't complicated. both across the US and in Europe, there are already laws around weapons not going to countries that are committing human rights violations. In the US, there are laws about weapons not going to countries that are withholding US aid from getting to where it's meant to go, which the Israeli government has consistently done, right? It is not controversial to say that Trump and Netanyahu should not be above our laws, right? That is the baseline standard for us to be pushing for. The other thing I want folks in Europe to know, you might not know this, but currently across Europe, your governments are helping enforce a Muslim ban. So if you're in Germany and you want to come to the US, most of you can apply for a visa waiver. But if you happen to be born in Iran, even if you are a German citizen, you have to get an actual visa to come to the US. So I would ask the German government why they are allowing the US to discriminate against your own citizens. Why are European countries allowing the US to create two tiers of citizens for you? Why are your governments allowing a Muslim ban to be enforced right now? And what can you do to stop it? Right. And then the other thing I will say is the level of dehumanization and racism that has been used to justify these wars has become like the air we breathe. It has become so commonplace that it is hard to spot. Right. When you see people making casual claims of war crimes, all of your leaders should be denouncing that. So most folks don't know that in Iran, there is also mandatory military service for men, right? I am terrified of members of my family having to be potentially be forced into that. And then you have people like Pete Hegseth saying the US Army will take no quarters, which in military speak is they will take no prisoners and they will just shoot to kill, right? That is a war crime. There should be international outrage when someone says things like that, right? And then beyond that, right? Whenever I say I am an Iranian Muslim feminist, people assume that my feminism came from how awful the Iranian government is. My feminism was shaped by generations of women before me, and when I was in Iran, of seeing their daily resistance. I would not be here talking to you all. I would not have my job had it not been for the legacy of the women's rights movement in Iran. And being able to tell those stories, tell our stories not just as victims, but as people who have consistently fought for something, tell the story of our resilience. After decades of being targeted, after decades of different governments really attacking progressives, leftists, people who want change and freedom in Iran, people are still protesting. People are still going, right? Tell those stories. And like what I will say is, what I think I'm going to speak for you too, and I hope you agree. It takes a lot of emotional energy to come on these calls and share the stories we do with you. And like the way you honor that commitment is by all of you taking at least one action. Pick one thing. There is no absolute right thing. But if you want to honor the like strength it takes to come on these calls and share these stories, then return it by doing one thing to actually make a difference.
What can I add? You speak so beautifully, both of you. Yeah, I agree with both things. I will just say that. I don't think I have anything else to add. Amira, I share your feeling of what else can we do. I share it. Our organization is also joining Protective Presence from time to time. And I admire the people who do it and also understand people who are afraid to do it. It has become extremely violent and is not being policed in any way by Israeli IDF. The opposite. Testimonies show that the opposite is True, and it is horrifying. I just want to say that it wasn't really part of the conversation, but it's horrifying. And with this horror come this moment when I say, but really, what can we do? And part of me wants to turn into Israel and say exactly, Sarah, what you said. I come from a society that insists for almost 7 years straight in the streets to resist this regime and its diplomacy. Sadly, it is not enough. It's not revolving enough the Palestinian issue. Not usually. I agree with that. And I think this is the one thing I would want to change. For example, you asked me earlier on, Amelie, about elections in Israel, and I forgot this question. Well, elections in Israel are coming, and there is a way to win them. It is if Jewish parties will sit with the Arab parties, they will win the elections. That it's a done deal. But the most of the Jewish parties will not do it. Okay. And so this kind of issue that is standing at the end between the loyalty to the IDF and wanting to live in a peaceful place is not really resolved in Israel. So I too say something similar to that. I believe in the power of democracy, and we are working within Israel to try and win this election and for things to be better. Support that. Do one action. Yes, at least one action. The move from a peace to war is a day. That's it. It's a decision. Enough people in places of power and enough people in the street can change that. Europeans should know that. Okay, of all people, Europeans should know that. You look back at these incredible wars and you go, what for? It could have been this way. So let's just bring this day closer. I hope we will manage to elect good people. I do think calling leaders in Europe speaking up is important. I do think it has an effect on Israeli society, strengthening it and curbing our government's actions. That's it.
Thank you very much. Oh.
But just sorry, but I just want to add one last phrase for what you said. Don't only condemn. Condemnation is great. It's good on Facebook and Instagram, you know, but it's not changing what the reality, the horrific reality we are living through. So encourage your politicians to take actions. It could be so many, you know. Today, ChatGPT knows the solution. So you can ask ChatGPT, they can ask ChatGPT. But I mean, like, really, stop condemning. Condemning is not changing anything. Take actions. Thank you.
Thank you to all of you. I think, looking at the question, this was really like the most burning question people have. Because, again, also from my own experience, I can say, it feels quite, bad to think that you can make a difference because there's other people in power making decisions. But, I think it really we have to take the heart of all of us to one action or, possibly, hopefully more than, there is a mass that at some point cannot be ignored. And I think that also what we talked about with the dehumanization, I think that's really the base for a lot of different conflicts and struggles. And there's a question related to that. So how do you think we can kind of grab it at the root, maybe teach cultural awareness at a young age? Or, what do you think is the best way to try to eliminate this dehumanization, which I think, really without dehumanizing other people, I think this whole the conflict wouldn't be possible because if you make them human, you just feel for them as well, and I think that would make a big change. So yeah, what is your opinion on that?
I have thoughts on that. First of all, I think it's an incredible task, and it's a task for parents and for education systems, and it goes through books. It goes the good messages can go through all the places where the bad messages go through. It's the same channels. It goes through books. It goes through television shows. It goes through education plans. It goes through all of that. Also, I find, and I speak as a parent here, that meeting people from the other side, I don't know, to play soccer, nothing too meaningful, just that already eliminates the sharpness of racism that we are saturated in. My society is saturated in racism as never before. It's a real peak. But if I say to my child something very small, remember your friend? You know where his father's from? Is where his father from? Or remember his actor? Do you know who his father is? Something like that. It just breaks the, it puts a face that he likes. Suddenly the reality becomes more complicated. It's not that hard to do. I do think there's a lot of forces working against that. But there is a lot of creativity. I think creativity can really make ways here. And parents, they have still, in a young age, they have still a lot to give. There is some freeway there. So yeah, I think that.
So here, I think there's two things. I think teaching kids about histories of oppression, about how like the way anti-Semitism works has laid a groundwork for the oppression of multiple other people as well. And like teaching them about various hatred is really important. And also what I know as a parent is kids learn more by how we act than what we say, right? So this is where I actually think like showing kids that when our leaders are saying horrific things, that we take action to stop it is one of the best ways of teaching them what is or isn't acceptable, and bringing them with us to parts of like how you create change in ways that make sense for them is really important too. And again, like this is, it's one thing to say it. It's one thing to read about it. And there is so many attacks there. Like in the US, we are seeing like a systematic erasure of like civil rights movement teaching from schools, which is horrific, right? So all of that is important. But if we don't pair it with action, I don't think the message is ever going to hit quite home. And if we don't pair it with like being there for our kids if they're experiencing it, then I think that's where we let them down.
Yes, thank you. Amira, do you want to add
Yeah.
anything?
Yeah, I want to just to add, I agree on what said answer it said, but I would like to add one important thing is to teach our youth how dehumanization works and how we can, stop this thing from happening. And when I say it for all youth around the world. It could be Israel, Palestine, it could be Iran, Israel, it could be America, I don't know, Cuba, everything, all the conflicts around the world. And how we do it. With one tool they have, they all have. It's their phones. It's their social media. It's this tool in between their hands. Let them have, give them access to real human being stories. When you tell someone a personal story and not Benjamin Netanyahu, this, that, you tell him your story, your personal story. That's where humanization starts. When this person in front of you, listening to your human story, realizes that, oh, this person behind that screen or in person is a human being, is just a normal person who has a mother, a father, a son, a sister. So I think, yeah, we should expose them to more stories from the realities, beautiful stories. To show them not only the news that they watch on CNN or all kind of these channels, but to show them the documentaries about the beauty of this place of this country. You know, like for example, I met lots of youth in my life and spoke to them. And for example, what they see about Palestine is war. Like everybody here is Hamas, and everybody here wants to kill everybody. And this is how they you know portray us. But then you start giving them documentaries, links, YouTube pages to show the beauty of Palestine. Palestine is beautiful. And Palestine, I mean both Palestine and historical Palestine. It's a beautiful country, and it has so many beautiful people. And it's not all conflict only, and they have to see that part.
Yes, thank you all. I think it was a very powerful both testimonies, and I think it's good to have this call for action, and you know, and feel like there's a common understanding. So thank you very much for that. Looking at the time, it's also perfectly timed. We're nearly done, so I'm gonna give the word to Max for some closing words. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. I was in the background reading all your questions and listening to what you four all said, and it was really powerful. And many people that follow Europe Calling longer know that my mom usually is in the audience as well, and she wrote me a message, and because we were speaking about family, and you know how important that is, and I just want to read the translation. I didn't ask her before, just doing it. So, mom, I'm sorry if I shouldn't, but I think it's important for everyone to hear. So my mom says, "I'm so shocked and sad, and I can't help but think what amazing women they are and how privileged we are to live here," speaking from Germany. And I think, you know, those are the feelings that you elicited, and you brought, and your people's thinking and listening to you. And this is so important. And I really respect what you said, Sarah, about you know the emotional stress that is also to share those stories. And this is even more I'm admiring that you have the strength to do that. So thank you very much for that. To everyone who kind of has more questions, we have several more questions, especially also very concrete questions about, you know, how could peace concretely look in the Middle East, and, you know, systems of government between Palestine and Israel, for example. We actually done a webinar on this, on the more like a concrete things and concrete models back in November. So we're going to share that in the follow-up as well, because I think, you know, apart from those, of course, stories and, you know, more geopolitics, also then to think about the solution, what could actually be for a form of government, for example. So this is something we're going to share. But I think for today, the task was to listen and to understand more. And I think this has worked, at least for me. And when I read the comments, also my mom's, I think that has worked. And I'm very grateful for you all. I'm closing this now. There's no good way to end it. I wish you all and your families the very, very best. And let's hope that war and all the other wars will end very soon, that we're going to have governments that will end those wars and not start new ones just to end them. And and with that, I leave you into the night, wherever you are, or actually into the day, in the afternoon. So thank you very much, and see you at the next Europe Calling. We'll be on Thursday in a completely different topic, renewable energy. But you know, there are many topics to talk about, but this is not for tonight. So thank you very much, and have a nice evening. Thank you to the interpreters as well. Bye.